Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, voters reject the quarter-cent sales tax hikes for arts, parks, greenways, and education. What's next for those who would have received funding? We look at other election results and at CMPD's new use of force policy, one Kerr Putney says, is a living document that will change over time. Panthers franchise quarterback Cam Newton is out for the season on injured reserve, but will he ever be back? And state lawmakers have taken out their crayons again, this time to draw new congressional maps. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those and other stories. And seated around this roundtable, which isn't round, is Steve Harrison, political reporter for WFAE News. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Nick Oxner is the chief investigative reporter for WBTV News. Good morning to you.
Hello.
Jonathan Lowe is reporter anchor for Spectrum News. Hi.
Morning, Mike.
And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Mike.
We're all on the radio. We're all on Facebook Live. Turnout in the off-year election was, I think, what, 17%
exactly
in Mecklenburg County, but that 17% of eligible voters had a major impact on the outcome of the sales tax referendum. They said a resounding no to hiking the tax by a quarter cent to fund parks, arts, greenways, and education, not necessarily in that order. What was the final tally?
I believe 54%?
57-43.
Thank you.
It was about 69,000 voted against and 51,000 voted for. And we talked about this, you know, the last couple of weeks leading up to the election, that there was such a decided advantage in terms of fundraising and advertising. And in the end, it made no difference.
Absolutely. I mean, you would think they raised three-quarters of $1 million, the Partnership for a Better Mecklenburg. I believe the, you know, Mecklenburg Tax Alliance, they were opposed. They raised something like $1,500. Yeah. And it was, most of it was former Commissioner Matthew Ridenour's own personal funds. And
I think, didn't Tariq Bakari take out three or four billboards with his own money?
Yes.
Correct.
Yes, with his own campaign money. He split those ads between vote yes for me and vote no for the arts.
So what went wrong here?
I think, you know, well, okay, so immediately.
We only have an hour, right?
That's right.
Steve, Eric, and I were all at the campaign for the Partnership for a Better Mecklenburg, their results party.
I was not working.
Lucky you. Almost immediately afterwards, they had a statement ready, just responding to the vote not being ready.
You were there before the results came in. So were they optimistic prior to the results coming in?
You know, it was very interesting. And Steve and I were talking about this. Not only was the mood somber before we even had any results.
So they knew.
Yeah, I think they knew. But the other thing that really struck me and others, I think, was, you know, you have this huge coalition of arts groups, museums, and it was a small turnout.
It was
never
a small turnout.
Like 40 people in the room.
I mean, they were over at Free Range Brewing, which if you've been, it's on.
We did a show there.
Right. It's a large area.
Yes.
They've got inside and outside space. So it just wasn't full. But the point I was going to make was they almost immediately said that they don't fit. They kept blaming the ballot language, And yes, the ballot language was very simple in general. I think the voters that I talked to, even as they were coming out from the polls, they were sharing how they voted. They seemed very educated on where the money was going to go. Mm-hmm. And the consistent thing that I heard was they felt there were other priorities. So I don't know if the opposing side was able to get their message across with that $1,500, or if people were really educated thanks to journalism.
I think that, you know, you talk about the opposition with the $1,500, and what that bought them, you know, wasn't so much like the yard sign. I mean, it was a few yard signs on social media, but just having that, like, quote, opposition group, the free media, you know, like on this show and the newspaper,
we all quoted
TV,
them.
You know, TV. It's that, like, there's the four side, and then all of a sudden now you did have kind of approved, quote unquote, you know, opposition group. And that's really all they needed.
And I go back, though, Mike, to the process. We talked a lot over the summer, even before that on this show, about watching the county commission try to turn this jello into something that was manageable because they were doing it all on the fly. You know, right. They were adjusting percentages in front of the public. Oh, let's make it 39%. Oh, let's make it 37%. I think those things hurt them.
And because of that, you never really got the sense that this is something the county, even though commissioners generally, everyone but Pat Gotham, claimed to support this referendum. You never, they really wanted to raise a sales tax so bad, there was a lot of hemming and hawing. Well,
yes. But I will say, Nick, there were some, while Pat Gotham was the only one that actually went on record, there were, I know, behind the scenes commissioners that questioned how they came up with the funding model and how this money would be dispersed.
And on Tuesday night, there were only three who came to the party.
Really?
You know, yes.
Right.
Very noticeable.
The sales tax proponent, County Commissioner Susan Harden, who was on this program just prior to the vote with Daryl Williams on the other, and on the other
Felicia
side.
Felicia McDowell.
They weren't on the show.
Oh, okay.
But
Pat Gotham.
Pat Gotham and Ridenhour, Matthew Ridenhour, were on the show. Jeez. Anyway, she said, she blamed, as you said, the wording on the ballot, which was very vague, for the measure's defeat.
We knew that the ballot language was very unfriendly. I mean, we're a big community. In order for you to overcome the ballot language, you have to educate people. And no matter what the issue is, we know from our research on this, people start at no.
Well, Matthew Ridenhour, who was in the opposition, took issue with that.
What we saw tonight was not so much a response to the ballot wording so much as a rejection from the people of where the dollars were going to go.
Okay, who's right?
I love Commissioner Harden. She is passionate in this community, but I disagree with her on this point because, like I said, I was talking to people throughout this whole this was a campaign that went on for the better part of a year. This was something that went on for the better part of the year. That people were educated on this. If they voted, if they were engaged in this particular election, they were, from what I gather, everybody had the same. I don't know if you experienced this. I don't know if Steve experienced this. But every person that I asked, how do you feel about this proposed tax increase? No. Well, why? The answer was, I think there are other priorities in this community. What priorities? Affordable housing, public transportation. So to say that people were uneducated, I think maybe the ballot language was vague, but to say that they were uneducated,
well,
I think
it was vague by law.
Well, a couple of things. I agree with you, Jonathan. I think that is correct. At the same time, I also think that where they really missed the mark is they didn't start their campaign until into the summer, basically. And so their problem was that they didn't educate enough people, or they didn't persuade enough people. I mean, you only had 17% turnout. If you are hitting the people who are supposedly so passionate about parks and greenways and arts and education, it didn't show up.
Would it have won had this been next year when more people turned out?
Maybe. But if you look at the map of where the referendum won, as opposed to where it lost.
Uptown areas.
It's the whole center city area.
Right. And
that's it. And so that tells you, did they target wrong? Right? The other question I have in terms of in the education piece is, we talked about this last week, Mike, as you acutely noted, their messaging kept changing, right?
Yes.
What was the tax for?
Yeah.
All right?
They got a lot of with the ad campaign shifting in the last few weeks away from the arts to education and parks. And that night, I think on election night, Jeep Bryan of the ASC said, no, we weren't trying to be that wasn't disingenuous. We just, everyone knew it was an arts tax, so we were trying to move the needle on the other two. But that did, I think.
So in fact, Jeep Bryan that night said the change in wording and the change in focus of the advertising was in fact intentional.
We were finding through the research we were doing that people recognized the arts component of this, but weren't as aware of the potential to invest more fully in parks and greenways and in the schools.
Even though that may be the God's truth, was it perceived as being deceptive?
Well, that tells me there that they knew the arts thing and didn't support it, and so we found some other areas that we thought people might support to highlight those.
So 2 points on that. So let's look at how confusing this was. So the lion's share of the money was going to go to arts and parks, 45%. But if you look at the signs...
No, the lion's share, 45% was going to the arts.
Oh, excuse me.
18% was going to parks.
So I confused myself. Okay. Thank you, Mike. So, but if you look at the signs that they put out, it was parks, arts, and education.
Right.
So if you just look at the simple marketing, they were, it seemed, trying to promote the parks as getting more of the money when it was actually the arts. And the other thing that I would say, we talked about the parts of town that supported it versus didn't support it. Weeks out, I mean, they had money, the Four campaign. They were putting rows of signs up in areas like University City. I remember seeing them in the outskirts of the county. So I don't really know how you can say that people out in the, even in the suburban areas of Mecklenburg County, didn't know about this.
The least support came from voters in the Mint Hill area. And interestingly enough, maybe they didn't explain that a lot of the all of the surrounding towns were going to split up 5% of this $50 million,
right.
For their own arts and or parks projects. Did you think they understood that?
I think their message was muddled. I mean, the fact that they were switching midstream, I go back to the fact that they didn't even start until Labor Day, essentially. I think this thing was a mess altogether. They had a lot of money, and they didn't really know how to spend it.
And I think
that was revealed in the results.
I was just going to say, with these like special, with these taxes, I think, this is my opinion, I have no scientific data behind this, but if you look back to the transit tax, which passed, right, that was kind of a simple message. We're going to build a train. We're going to build a cool train, period. I mean, that was kind of it. And this, I just think the moment you have to start really explaining, well, we're going to do parks.
So there's no tangible.
Art. It's like the moment you have to like take a paragraph, people are done.
I mean, and people even kept, it was like point, counterpoint. When it came out that they raised $750,000, people then said, well, why don't you just give that money to the arts, parks, and education?
But that would be a one-shot deal. This was going to be...
like, correct.
This was going to go on and on.
$25 million.
The money would go up.
But it was just like there was, for every reason that they gave, people, the opposing side came back with...
So political scientist Dr. Eric Heberle from UNC Charlotte told The Observer that arts funding is a priority of city elites, not the average voter. Does the arts sector have... this is my opinion. I think the arts sector has a problem with the word arts. They ought to ditch it from their vocabulary because arts is hoity-toity. Mm-hmm. If you just say Les Mis, theater, if you say the Charlotte Symphony and Summer Pops, you got them. You say arts... and that's hoity-toity.
Yeah, and it's interesting because they tried to emphasize reinstating the school field trips to go to museums and symphony and things like that. But I don't think they ever, again, because they kept bouncing around from thing to thing, I don't think they ever got to the heart of it. And it didn't resonate with people. It was too scattered.
What about the field trips? Ann Doss Helms was on this. She's our education reporter. She was on this program right in the aftermath of all of this. And she tried to get some information from the school system about these field trips. It seemed the advertising was making it appear that all these field trips were gone. They were canceled. And yet, as we do this show, there are kids walking down the street to go to Discovery Place, and there are buses parked around the Imaginon, so you knew that wasn't true.
Right. And there's parents who know they have to pack pack the disposable bag lunch. So they know their kids are on field trips.
So had these field trips actually been curtailed, or were they trying to increase the number of
They were trying to increase. They were trying to increase the number, but
once again, duplicity, mendacity.
Look, he went Tennessee Williams on us on a Friday.
That's right. See, arts.
Elite.
That's where the arts come into play.
That's where the arts come into play. But again, wouldn't that be an easy thing to illustrate, to show children, whatever, going to the museum or arts class? And maybe they did in limited doses, but I don't feel like it was pervasive.
It wasn't. In the very first...
Or the culture blocks. I'm sorry, Jonathan. The culture blocks, where they take it into the neighborhood, this program that they do with Mecklenburg County that's been growing. They mentioned it. I don't know how much people really understood.
Because that's not where this whole thing started.
Right.
And I don't know if Eric or... Steve, if y'all were there, if y'all remember, but the very first presentation that the Arts and Science Council did, they just talked about the needs there. They didn't talk about these field trips and all this other stuff.
When we come back, more election results. We'll also get into the new use of force policy announced yesterday by CMPD at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Behind the scenes, we're talking about the arts. We're talking about Les Mis. So it just goes to show you there's a role for arts in life.
Jean Valjean was full when I went to go see Les Mis. People from all over the place.
That's right. So that is the voice of Nick Oxner, who just saw Les Mis for the first time. He's the chief investigative reporter for WBTV News, and he's going to be looking into the role of Javert.
No Jean Valjean for him.
Should That's I be insulted by that?
No, not at all. Because I think his conduct is over the top. Steve Harrison is our political reporter here at WFAE News. Jonathan Lowe is a reporter anchor for Spectrum News, who we're going to slight because he's never seen Les Mis. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. I didn't even look at where we should go next.
We call this show Playbill now, right? Yeah.
So the ASC was described as being in crisis prior to this arts vote.
Mm-hmm.
If that's true, and it probably is because their funding has precipitously declined in the last
since 2008.
What now?
Well, that is what they're going to spend the next couple of weeks to months figuring out. Jeep Bryant said the other night as the returns came in that they will go back to the people who supported them and talk about what the next steps are. And he tried to put an optimistic tone to his remarks by saying that this campaign has ignited a lot of interest and shown a lot of support for the arts, even though they didn't pass the referendum. So he's hoping that those people will go on and help them come up with a way to figure out the funding.
And I think one thing that comes next real quick mm-hmm. is that I think we're about to have a double whammy for the arts because this month, city council will go into closed session and will probably approve a deal to give subsidies for soccer using hospitality tourism taxes that, in theory, could pay for the arts because those are tourism draws. And so it's going to be just a little bit of a...
Could it not be argued that so are the arts?
Well, no. Yeah, this is interesting. And Steve asked the question a couple times at the event the other night. And the answer that is given and is going to be given is from the tourism perspective, they're going to say, look, we paid for the Beckler, we paid for the Discovery Place renovations, we pay for facilities, but we have not funded the groups themselves, and that's just not the way that we've tackled this
That's one of the problems from an insider's point of view in Charlotte. We have some of the most magnificent facilities of a city this size. I mean, there are probably more theaters in the space here between College Street and the Knight Theater down on South Tryon than there are on Broadway in the same amount of real estate.
Mm-hmm.
So we have all these great facilities, but they don't fund the people who fill the stages, which is something they need to address. The Observer was against this referendum. They came out against it in their editorials, and the day after it didn't pass, they admonished the Mecklenburg County commissioners to step up. They referenced a two-page ad on Sunday before Election Day in which hundreds of supporters went public with their support, including seven members of the commission, a majority of the county commission. And the paper said they should now support the struggling arts, these are their words, now support the struggling arts community with reasonable, sustained funding in the next county budget. They should demand an arts proposal that benefits the whole community. They should better fund a financially neglected parks and greenway system. What is the likelihood that any of that will happen?
Well, it's interesting. We talked to George Dunlap after the vote, and he said that while these are needs, these are important issues that need to be addressed, he did not feel the need to go after this immediately. And I thought the possibilities that he mentioned were a little bit vague. He said, well, you know, if the tax money keeps going up or if we do this or that, but there was no real, we are going to tackle this. And that's in stark contrast to Susan Harden, who said, we can't wait 2 years to put this back on the ballot. We need to do something now. It doesn't sound like they're heading
that
direction.
And I think the ballot, I think it's over. I don't think they'll try again. I mean, after...
Well, this is the second time.
This is the second time. Like
and the percent, 61% voted against 5 years ago, and they improved a little bit. But
$1 million, 4%.
Yeah. And 5 years ago, education was the front runner, and arts was the secondary. This time it was flipped, and it still lost. The region has a lot of other needs, as people told you, Jonathan, mm-hmm. as you talked to them as they left the voting booth. And one of those needs is transit. City Council delayed a decision on giving CATS the $50 million they'd like to have to fund a study for designing the Silver Line, which will run, if it runs at all, from Matthews across the river into Belmont in Gaston County. They wanted to delay that until after they saw what the voters said to the sales tax vote. This defeat leaves the possibility open to using that quarter-cent tax as a transit option. And on the day after the election, I asked Mayor Vi Lyles if she thought voters would approve a hike in the tax for transit.
I think that we've got to make that argument. I think we've got to lay out what it means to do something like this. But it's not just, you know, I think we're kind of reducing the sales tax to the silver line. But what we've got to do is figure out how to have transportation improvements throughout the city.
Is this something that either city council or county commission will do? I mean, we've had two sales tax referendums in 5 years. Both were voted down. Are they likely to put another one on the ballot for transit?
Oh, I think you saw the city council in the last few weeks going, oh, sales tax? We have the silver line would cost this much? I mean, and suddenly they were questioning, why would we raise this for the arts? So I think there are many members of the city council who are eyeing this as a possible funding solution.
But I think one more thing on that. I mean, the quarter cent tax, it's just not enough to pay for the silver line.
So no,
you
it's
have
not.
To go to, you have to go to Raleigh.
Pay for the study, and that's it.
You have to go to Raleigh to get permission to do like at least a half or a full penny to make this happen.
Right. But I think in talking to a couple of city council members last week, they do see this as that there has to be a sales tax option in there.
But, you know, the building of the actual building of the line will cost billions
Correct.
Of dollars. And the sales tax raises millions of dollars.
And right. And so they're comparing it to the blue line. And that was about $1 to $2 billion. So right now you can only double it. But, you know, who's to say it
and
won't
be even
more?
And that was in dollars, pre-recession
Correct.
Dollars.
So
pre-recession dollars. And, of course, you know, you have the how much is the federal government going to come up with? I think the last I heard was maybe 30-40%. What's the state going to do? Mike, how many years? It feels like 100 years we've been talking about a regional transit plan yeah. and funding and taxes and everybody buying in. It doesn't seem to be moving real
that
fast.
That train may have left the station.
Yes.
Right. It should not be overstated that city council has a strategy session tomorrow, and they could very likely vote on going ahead with okay. this $50 million design contract, which gets the ball rolling.
So there yes. were other races in this election, which we should talk about. Were there any real surprises here outside of the suburbs? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
No. Mayor Vialiles handily won her race. She'll be working with a council that only has two newcomers on it. Given her margin of victory and the fact that most of the council members are coming back, they're veterans, they know where the bathrooms are, will they see her victory as a mandate to go ahead with some of the things she'd like to do, continue her quest for affordable housing, her quest for transit, et cetera? And are they already in motion? They don't have to pick up from zero and start up. They've been going for 2 years now.
Already felt like she's had a mandate to me.
Right. I talked to a lot of people Tuesday night just in having regular conversation, and there was a lot of polling that they did as part of on the four side. And residuals, they looked at how the mayor's doing. She's extremely popular all across Mecklenburg County. She polls really high. So, you know, ultimately, I think that she has a lot of momentum behind her right
first,
now.
She was the first to point out on Wednesday morning that her opponent, who runs perennially and never campaigns, pulled almost a quarter of the vote.
Right. Democrats get a lot of criticism for like blind voting. Right. You hear that in the media a lot.
Yeah,
right. Oh,
right,
they'll support whatever Democratic candidate. But this recent election goes to show that Republicans are guilty of that,
yes,
too.
Yeah.
That, like you said, a quarter of the vote went for the candidate who once wanted to rename the city Ricetown. Right?
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's serious. There was a toss-up in Matthews. There were two races that were surprises. What, Matthews-Huntersville?
Yep.
In Matthews, Mayor Paul Bailey was defeated by Mayor Pro Tem John Higdon. And Paul Bailey is the guy who used to be on the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board, who then became the mayor of Matthews and proposed this
HB 514, the charter school bill.
To allow Matthews, the city, to have its own charter schools that they would run. Was this vote, which I think was 54-46 against the current mayor, mm-hmm. was that based on this idea or was something else in play here?
I think absolutely. John Higdon said when he won in the primary back in September that his main reason for running against Paul Bailey, somebody who he's known for 25 years, was because of Bailey's support of HB and endorsement of HB 514.
So the voters didn't want it either.
It sounds like it.
But in Huntersville, the exact opposite happened, right?
Yes, Mayor John Anarala, the incumbent who won on election night, has is run in part on a platform of having municipal charter schools. Huntersville and Matthews were trying to do this at the same time in the HB 514 era.
And I was going to say, didn't we just have, it was Cornelius that decided they would move closer to the school system so that they could get back in the funding pool? So
yes.
There's no clear overarching sentiment here when it comes to the towns and the schools or the four towns that were involved in that.
Well, Higdon definitely said when he won after the primary, sorry, Steve, that he wants to repair the relationship with CMS. So it will be interesting to see if we have now, with this changing of the guard in Matthews, a closer relationship between CMS in the town of Matthews, but then things kind of continue to splinter off in North Mecklenburg.
And to be clear about this, once they announced their intention to follow this mandate to build their own schools, CMS kind of said, well, we're going to stop
right.
building schools, because why should we put school buildings that are going to be empty, because you're going to have your own schools.
Yeah, what was it they wanted you to say for 15 years you wouldn't do that if you wanted to stay in the queue, in essence?
So, and they have an overcrowding problem over there. So does Huntersville, I'm sure. But Huntersville and that whole part of the county has long been in favor of splitting away.
Yes.
So maybe that's just a different set of
politics.
This was the year for at-large seats to be up for grabs on the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board. Every other election cycle, they do at-large and district. So this was the at-large time. There were three seats open, with incumbent Elise Dashew winning her race with 12.9% of the vote, followed by Jennifer Dillagera and Lenora Shipp, if I pronounced Jennifer's name correctly. Given these two newcomers and the departure of school board chair Mary McCray and Erica Ellis Stewart, who's been on the school board for a long time, both of whom decided not to run, will we see changes in policy or the way business is conducted at the school board going forward?
Well, I think whether they go in a different direction or not, it's going to be different because you have different people. They're going to do things differently. You have new dynamics, and you have a new superintendent. So it's not going to be the same. How it's going to be different, I can't answer, but it will be different. The other thing I wanted to mention, though, Mike, is I'm still struck by, for people who don't think their vote matters, 187 votes between Lenora Shipp and Stephanie Sneed as to who got on the school board.
Right. And it's Jennifer De La Jara. Excuse me, I'm sorry. All right, this week, CMPD Chief Kerr Putney unveiled reforms of the department's use of force policy, which I think happened just yesterday. This policy governs when and how law enforcement officers are allowed to use their guns, tasers, or other types of weapons, and it's in part because they want to reduce the use of deadly force. CMPD Chief Kerr Putney said that the announcement marked a pivotal day for the department and is the result of a year and a half of conversations with community activists and other groups.
We debated a lot. You guys gave us a deep appreciation for what you wanted to see, improvements you expected.
So how are things changing under this new policy?
So this is called, now they're referring to their use of force policy, they being Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police, response to resistance. And I think the biggest highlight in there is the de-escalation has always been a part of their use of force policy, but now this is the first time that it's defined.
And it's written in
Correct.
The policy. What does that mean, and how will it change things? Just because it's written into the policy, what does that mean?
Well, it says the chief basically said that now it's written in there and that the public can hold them accountable on it.
Okay.
Simply said.
And it's a 17-page policy,
14 pages.
So it's not a long, big book of policy. It's fairly easy to digest.
It also, Mike, puts in there that officers have to render medical aid that is commensurate with their training, which the chief did not say that these updates are in response to the Danquarius Franklin officer-involved shooting, but that is one thing that we saw social activists raise as a serious concern, is whether Officer Wendy Curl or any other officer at the scene that day at Burger King rendered medical aid to Mr. Franklin.
The Observer noted that researchers who study law enforcement and local activists call this move significant because it sends the message that police are serious about reducing the number of violent encounters.
Yep.
But Chief Putney has always insisted, and he insisted again at this press conference yesterday, that if a perpetrator has a gun,
it's a game changer.
That changes everything. So how does this new policy deal with that?
I think it tries to, the chief, and what I was going to say is that he said this is the culmination of several officer-involved shootings. But the objective is, in the chief's words, to give them space, time, distance between the officer and the subject so as to get to a point where they can de-escalate. Mm. So, but he, at the end of the day, he said this does not change the legal standard of perceiving a deadly imminent threat. So, again,
this puts the onus on officers in the field who have to make split second life determining situations.
Yes.
It seems to me.
But the chief said this does not mean that officers are expected to take any sort of pause whenever. And this is the chief's words.
Yeah, well, it's a nationwide trend, and former CMPD Chief Daryl Stevens, who is also a former executive director of the Major Cities Chiefs Association, says it's likely some CMPD officers will be concerned, though not surprised, by this policy change. Was that brought up in this press conference? How concerned might officers be that suddenly they have to take this into consideration?
I don't know. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, because I did reach out and speak to one of the leaders of the Fraternal Order of Police here. Mm-hmm. And what he told me is that they really don't see much new or different with the updates, and that he needed, at that point, he needed to read more into it in detail. But what he was hearing from other officers was that this is something they kind of expected, or,
yeah,
or
I think they know,
already do.
I think they know that the chief is under pressure.
To say something. Yeah.
And so I think there's a bit of probably in the department a read between the lines, like when you said the line about the gun being a game changer. Mm-hmm. If I'm an officer, I kind of focus on that statement
not so much what's
newly written down.
This feels like, and maybe writing it down makes a big difference, but it just feels like something that they've been saying over and over for years. I guess it is a change in the technical policy.
And this is not a one-shot deal. Putney says it's not a one-shot deal. It's a living, breathing document. He said, I wish I could tell you we got it perfect this time. I'm sure we did not. So this policy is subject to change as events occur. One thing that is different is that Chief Putney invited feedback going forward, and Robert Dawkins, who heads up Safe Coalition NC, is ready to provide that feedback.
I'm generally positive because, again, even the chief admits we won't stop here. But what we do see is that the community got more input on this. We've gotten this to look at, and he also followed it up to say he wants feedback. We will definitely be giving feedback.
Of course, to receive feedback, you have to be in office, and we'll talk about the odds of that are with his retirement pending coming up in a moment. In this last break, we were talking about Cats, but not the musical. It is the local.
So elitist, isn't it?
Thank you. It's the local news roundup here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Steve Harrison is here. He's our political reporter. He's been silent during all of the breaks. He won't talk about any of this.
He's going to sing Jellicle Cats.
That's right. Jonathan Lowe is here. He's reporter, anchor for Spectrum News. Nick Oxner is the chief investigative reporter for WBTV News. We'll be looking into that later. And Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. So to get feedback, as Robert Dawkins just said about this new policy, you have to be the chief of police. And that's up in the air because retirement's on Chief Putney's mind. He was going to retire at the end of the year, take 2 months off, come back in March as the chief, work through the Republican National Convention, and then retire again. But that, as we all know, has run into some resistance from State Treasurer Dale Falwell, who says his plan is at odds with state law. The city continues to disagree, and Chief Putney was asked this week if he has changed his retirement plan, considering all of that, and here's how he responded.
No.
Excuse me, say that again?
No.
What?
No.
Okay. I get it, so.
That's my second favorite answer.
It's the shortest soundbite in the history of radio. So what is the latest?
So this is an interesting game of chicken we're playing now, right, between Chief Putney, the city of Charlotte, and State Treasurer Dale Falwell, mm-hmm. where – this week the city issued pages and pages more new memos and letters from people with law degrees justifying why they think they're correct. And I can tell you the treasurer continues to say, no, I'm right. Now, in this game of chicken, only one person has the power to write a check. So this stands to reason. You can make all the arguments you want if you're Chief Putney or the city. And let's be clear, I think this is a situation where Chief Putney's getting some advice from city and lawyer people on his end that may or may not be right, but they think they're right.
The law says a public employee can only collect pension after, quote, complete separation from active service with no intent or agreement expressed or implied to return to service. But that's always been the plan, to return. Go away.
And that's what the treasurer in this case says is the problem.
The announcement.
Had they not said, and he's definitely going to come back in 2 months, you could wink and nod your way through.
What is the city's argument in opposition to that?
Well, part of their argument is they hired an outside law firm, Pointer and Spruill, that says one of the arguments that the state treasurer is making is that you have to comply with IRS guidelines. They're saying that you don't.
The treasurer said yesterday, I'm glad the city hired an outside attorney to tell me about my own plan. You know, like which is true, right? I mean, and like Nick said, he writes the checks. He wins.
And he said, despite everything the city has said, his opinion on all of this has absolutely not, that's a quote, absolutely not changed despite the city's outside opinion.
They went out and got a legal opinion on the plan that they don't have the responsibility for. Our legal opinions are coming from the attorneys, both in Washington and here in the treasurer's office, who have had and still have the responsibility for administering the plan.
So if the state refuses to budge, which seems likely, will Chief Putney delay his retirement so he can stay through the convention? Because that has been the big thing. Everybody wants him to stay because of his experience with the DNC.
So the one word, what the message I glean from the one word answer is, I am retiring. Right. I mean, when we were in Austin, when they announced the RNC was coming officially to Charlotte, I remember being in the airport, I think, with the mayor and saying, hey, have you heard that Chief Putney's going to retire before the convention? And she said, I sure hope not. And I don't know that there was a lot of awareness among some of the senior city leaders at the government center that Chief Putney's time he planned for his time to be up here before the convention. And I think there was an effort from folks in the government center to want to get him to stay. I don't know that he necessarily has a burning desire to stay through the RNC.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So when might we expect some definitive answer here? Because it's apparently we're at a stalemate.
Well, he's talking about retiring at the end of this calendar
January 1st.
So
if he shows up on January 1st.
Yeah, it's pretty evident.
What's at play here? Because we're talking about 8 additional months. So what's at play here? Why is it so important? Is it the fact that he thought he could double dip, essentially, get the retirement pay and chief pay when he came back in March for a couple of months?
What if he just had no interest in working RNC and it's like, I'm out?
Well,
City said, please, no, don't leave.
Yeah, well.
And what if he said, no,
I'm leaving?
I just wanted to use one more answer.
You want him to say no again?
Yeah.
You do?
Please do. I want to hear it.
Okay.
No.
That's really quick.
Somebody is on that
the
button.
Control room.
Yes. You know, that's we live in a digital world. We didn't even have to rewind the tape.
Can that take us out at the end of your show today?
Let me think about that. Okay. Speaking of people leaving, the Panthers franchise quarterback Cam Newton has been out since the preseason with a Lisfranc injury to his foot, coming off last season's shoulder injury.
That's from Les Mis, by the way.
And now the team has put him. See, even the football players are into the arts. Now the team has put him on the injured reserve list. What does that mean for the team and for Cam Newton?
Will he play again for the Carolina Panthers? Well, if I had control, you'd play the clip. No. So, that's really what it boils down to. He has 1 year left on his contract. It would cost the team $21 million. It's much easier to part ways with him for $2 million and find a new quarterback or go with Kyle Allen or whatever they decide to do, because, in part, they have a number of high-profile players who are also coming up at the end of their contracts. They're going to
the NFL has all these rules and timetables. Is that why they put them on injured reserve now as opposed to 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks from now?
I think that they still held out some hope that he might play again. I think they've just he went and saw that foot specialist, and I think now they just realize he's not going
to
play.
So yeah, I actually think it would have been beneficial for them to put him on injured reserve earlier before the trade deadline and maybe pick up some new talent while you have that open roster spot. So I actually, to Eric's point, think it was disadvantageous for them to wait this long. And so it shows they were really committed to if they could get him back, to having him back.
So for weeks, the media has been peppering Ron Rivera, Coach Rivera, with questions about Cam's status and his expected return date. And Rivera,
he loves those questions.
He's found that extremely tiresome. As was a question this week about whether he might be in shape to play if the Panthers made the playoffs.
Just so everyone understands, that question will not be addressed until it's time to address, okay? So at the end of the day, he's on IR, all right? Kyle Allen's our quarterback.
So you're saying you're not going to the playoffs, Coach? Oh, sorry, I was just playing the role.
I wonder if there's a way to loop the Chief and Rivera together.
The answer, of course, is no.
All right, Scott Fowler, a sports columnist, the leading sports columnist, I guess, for the Charlotte Observer, suggested that this should be curtains for Cam for any number of reasons, not the least of which is, as you pointed out, Eric, it will save the team $21 million next year. So how do you make a decision like this? This guy has been the quote-unquote franchise quarterback. He was the MVP, the only Panther MVP in the history of the franchise. How do you make a decision like
this? I mean, pro sports, particularly the NFL, it's such a cruel business. I mean, they just, you know, most teams do not have trouble saying, you know what, next. You know, it sounds heartless. Maybe it is, but that's just kind of the way pro football works. So I think they will do that. They will look at that salary cap, and they will look at what they have to do and say, this is not going to work for us.
When you look at the difference in management style between Jerry Richardson and David Tepper, what should that tell you about this upcoming decision?
Well, I think the bigger thing is to look at Marty Herney, who's the general manager, and who said between his tenures that he was too loyal to players. He got too close to players and wanted to hang on to them too long. And so now he's much more likely to cut ties before he signs a contract that proves costly to the team in multiple ways.
So Rock Hill's Planning Commission, no surprise here, approved a recommendation this week to rezone the property where the Panthers want to build their new headquarters. The Rock Hill City Council has the final vote on November the 25th. Any prognostications on which way that decision might go?
No. I mean, yes. Yes. I think that'll be pretty easy. Okay, so I think that's a go.
And the Panthers hope to break ground there by April. Consider it done.
Yes.
North Carolina legislators have begun the process of redrawing the state's congressional maps. This follows state judges last week blocking further use of the current maps because there was, quote, evidence of likely excessive partisan bias in the drawing of those district maps. No. Now the legislature has to draw these maps in full view of the public, evidently as exactly the way they did the legislative maps. How do they do that? How are they accomplishing this in full view of the public?
Live streaming. In real Technicolor broadcast.
And what does that do for us? It just keeps the...
Well, look, this is a massive change because, as has been the subject of much court debate over the last 6 months, maps were previously drawn by Republicans and by Democrats when they controlled the General Assembly in someone's basement or on Thomas Hofeller's, you know, hard drive in his house with in no way public, right? And so what the court did on these legislative maps is they ordered, you will redraw these maps, you'll do it in 2 weeks, and you will do it literally in full view of the public, not in your staff committee room, not in your car, not in wherever. You're going to do it. And so they did.
And they did it. Yeah, that's the thing, Nick, is they were successful.
And look, nothing about the General Assembly is, even when they're trying to be transparent, they just can't help themselves, right? I mean, half the time this work goes on in rooms in the General Assembly that don't even have live streaming and audio capability and that are too small to fit in all the spectators who want to watch. And so here the court said, you will do this very publicly. And you know what? They did it. And so in the order that said, we're probably going to make you draw new congressional maps, They said, well, you did it so well the first time, we're going to ask you to do it again. And in this case, the General Assembly said, yeah, that worked out okay. Yeah. And so we'll just go ahead and do it before you make
us. So far, like the process with these congressional maps, a lot of people have been pretty horrified by the draft maps that have come out. The work in progress, where, like Nick said, the state house maps, everybody was pretty happy with that. So far on this one, I mean, you kind of watch the legislators kind of go through with a little mouse and they click. And even if you don't have the partisan data and the voting data in front of you, everybody knows pretty much the entire state where Democrats and Republicans live. And you just watch them click and they just like take out Democrats. So it's still happening in real time.
But there are, what, 18 Republicans and Democratic members of this organization, this committee that's doing this. Is it evenly divided 9-9 or is it majority Republican?
Yeah, majority Republican.
Democrats wanted to start the process from scratch. Republicans wanted to use what they're calling theoretical districts that a bipartisan group of former judges created a couple of years ago by Common Cause, North Carolina. Have they made a decision on which process they're using, or are they already in the middle of one of these?
They're already in the middle of one of these. I mean, okay. I think that they were clicking away yesterday, and are they doing some more clicks today, or are they taking the weekend off? So the interesting question will be: this is in public.
Well, if I wanted to watch them do this, how do you find out where to go to do that?
On the live stream, it's on. Definitely on the General Assembly's website, ncleg.gov.
Like everybody would know that. Okay.
Google North Carolina General Assembly.
I'm sure you go to any sports bar, they have it on.
Yeah, that's probably right. But the question to Steve's point will be, everyone was happy with the legislative districts because ultimately they kind of took care of all the incumbents everywhere, more or less, right? Here you have no incumbents because they're drawing districts of people for a different body other than theirs. And so even if it's done in public, will it change the end result, right? You could change the means and the methods, but will it change the outcome?
Some of the early maps for Mecklenburg County, the gerrymanders are worse and they look crazier than the map that was thrown out.
And the court did not give these folks a deadline to get this done, but I would assume there is some urgency here.
Yes,
filing
December 2nd.
December 2nd through the 20th. Can they do it by then?
Yes, the goal is to
because
have it.
It has to go to the courts first, right?
That is not explicitly clear. So all it's important to note, all the court said on the congressional maps were, you can't plan to use these in an election for now, but we haven't made a final determination if you can or not. And so this is the General Assembly trying to be proactive. They could end up using those, but if they do it on their own timetable, it's very possible they could just pass these. There it will be. Their plan is to come back next week. The General Assembly is coming back into session next week anyways for a little bit, and to maybe pass these.
So in 1 minute or less, Governor Roy Cooper this week vetoed one bill addressing potential voting in the state by non-citizens and signed another strengthening the mail-in absentee ballot rules. What was the non-citizen thing about? I mean, do non-citizens vote?
So this particular bill would have stricken voters from the rolls who show up for jury duty and are excused from jury duty for not being citizens. And so this would take them off the voter rolls. Governor Cooper vetoed it.
And how is the bill strengthening absentee rules working? What is that all about?
It's changing a number of things, largely addressing stuff that came up in last year's 9th Congressional District, also adding Saturday voting to the last Saturday before elections again.
Governor Cooper also this morning vetoed teacher raises, calling the raises paltry. He says he will negotiate the pay raises of teachers and other educators separate and apart from Medicaid expansion. And he says, I urge all legislators from both parties to help us come together and support our teachers. And in a dueling press release, Senate Leader Phil Berger said Governor Cooper uses teachers as pawns, blocking their pay increases, then trying to convince them all it's the Republicans' fault. This week, Monday Night Football viewers saw a cat make a touchdown. And the cat was not a Panther, no surprise there. It was the game between the Giants and the Cowboys, and at some point, a black cat ran out onto the field at MetLife Stadium.
He's walking to the 3, he's at the 2, now a policeman, a state trooper has come on the field, and the cat runs into the end zone! That is a touchdown!
Yes! Instead of being credited with a score, they wanted to charge the cat with delay of game, but they couldn't figure out which team he was playing for. That's all they got. We're done. We're finished. Mercifully.
Throw the flag.
That's right. Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Nick Oxner, chief investigative reporter for WBTV News. Jonathan Lowe, reporter, anchor for Spectrum News, and our own political reporter for WFAE, Steve Harrison. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.